Today in Studio 360, I visit the scene of the most beautiful crime ever committed with the criminal himself.
I was a young wire walker busy conquering an idea.
Philippe Petit, who walked on a wire between the Twin Towers, now the subject of a new documentary.
I never thought of the consequences. I would have not cared if I had thought of the consequences.
And we look at how artists today are taking their own kind of risks. Like DJ Shadow, going to extremes to find his raw materials.
There'd be lots of times where part of the roof would fall on a stack of records, so as I'm flipping through them, and just sit there and cough for a while. And at a certain point, I thought maybe I should start wearing a mask.
And the painter, Kehinde Wiley, accepting his own occupational hazards.
They get in the way of painting, they urinate on paintings, but they're my buddies, and we deal with them.
That is all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today we'll visit painter Kehinde Wiley in his studio, and we'll take a walk with everyone's favorite cynical comedian, Bill Murray, for an unlikely cause. Poetry. But first, a much riskier walk.
There is somebody out there in a tightrope walk between the two towers of the World Trade Center, right at the tippy top.
It's August 7th, 1974, and Richard Nixon's about to resign, but it was this more surprising, literally marvelous news report that had the nation riveted.
That somebody was Philippe Petit, a 24-year-old Frenchman, doing his higher wire act 1,350 feet up and no net below. He and some associates managed to hide out in the World Trade Center towers overnight, and early this morning rigged a 140-foot steel cable between the two buildings using some sort of crossbow device.
Philippe Petit's illegal, death-defying walk between the towers 110 stories up is incredible to imagine. And incredible today because it's a piece of World Trade Center history that is not about September 11, 2001. A terrific new documentary about the walk called Man on Wire is out this weekend. And I met up with Petit and the film's director, James Marsh, at Ground Zero, the site of the Trade Center.
Philippe, here you are, 34 years later. You were 24 at the time. There you were, a quarter mile up. The Twin Towers were brand new. When you walked out there, do you remember what you felt like?
I have moment-to-moment memories, and the more I relive the past, the more I am able to actually recompose that and discovering new feeling that I thought had fluttered away. So, yes, I remember each of those eight crossing, and as you know, it was not planned. It just happened that I did one more and one more. It was a performance, but a strange kind of performance because my audience could not be invited in advance. And also they were a quarter of a mile below me. So, but still it was a performance. But it was also a very intimate dialogue with me and the birds, me and the sky of New York, me and the Twin Towers.
You and history as well. You must have thought...
No, I never thought of that.
No,
I was a young wire walker busy conquering an idea. I never thought of the consequences. I would have not cared if I had thought of the consequences. And I never thought of the fame, if it would come, knock at my door. No, this was not the reason I was there, and it was not part of my thinking.
You mentioned that you... And the film reenacts the moment when you first got this idea. Is talk about that. It was only what, 6-7 years before you actually did it. How did that happen?
Well, exactly as James reconstructed it and tells in his photoplay. I like that term.
Indeed, it's a photoplay.
Because it's a play. I mean, and the first scene is actually how I got the idea, and it's exactly how it appears in the film.
Here I am, young, 17 years old, with a bad tooth in one of those uncolorful waiting room of a French dentist, and you have all ladies and people, you know, sheepishly looking at magazines, quiet, and suddenly I freeze, because I have opened a newspaper at a page, and I see something magnificent, something that inspires me. I see two towers, And the article says one day those towers will be built. They're not even there yet. And when they are, they will become the highest in the world.
And yes, I saw two buildings that was a rendering because at the time they didn't exist yet.
And do you remember the first time you arrived in New York, sort of casing the joint and saw the...
I remember everything. I am an archivist at heart, and I have a sense for details. For example, before you said hello, I saw you arrive, and I know that the third button on your left sleeve is about to fall. Okay, so this is who I am. The street juggler in me pay attention. So yes, I remember vividly my first impression of New York. It was old and dirty, smelly, because there was a strike of garbage, and it was modern and beautiful. It was a big mess. And I remember my first vision of the towers and my first visit illegally in the towers.
You say that you noticed the button on my jacket, which is amazing. James, when you first met Philippe, he told you he had the mind of a criminal. Does that seem so?
Well, I'd read Philippe's book by the time we met, and his book lays out a very elaborate criminal conspiracy that he undertook with close friends and associates he found in the city. Certainly, I think that the kind of lateral thinking, the kind of imagination that he needed to conceive of this crime, if you like, and to conceive of the logistics of it and to execute it was, you know, clearly the mind of someone who didn't respect boundaries and laws and rules. And that's one of the things I love
sanity,
about the story.
Some could argue.
I wouldn't argue that. But that's one of the things that I love about the story itself, is it has no respect for, you know, even the laws of nature, ultimately, in a way. So I wasn't surprised to find a man rummaging in my pockets and stealing things from me. And that was, I think, the basis under which we collaborated, was that sense of mischief and playfulness.
Philippe, you say in the film that while it was illegal, it wasn't wicked or mean, this violation of the law and of the norms of modern life. Did you see yourself at 24 as a kind of holy outlaw?
Oh, absolutely, but not at 24. It started at 4 years old. 4, 5, 6 years old, I was already building my independence and shaping my destiny. So yes, this kind of need for rebellion, and one could see it as arrogance, still is in me after all these years.
I remember people talking about how, oh, this amazing act had humanized these gargantuan new buildings. Did you have any thought of, well, if you fail, if you fall?
Well, I would have loved to be able to have such a thought, but I am incapable of
really?
Having such thoughts. I concentrate and I live and I walk forward what I want to do, which is to walk on a cable, the opposite of walking on a cable, flying away from a piece of steel on which you walk. I'm incapable of entertaining that thought because it's in a different world than the one that I have created and I decided to live in.
Yeah, so it is the ultimate power of positive thinking.
I don't think it's only thinking. I think it's much more than that. I think it's the chemistry of your blood in your veins and the pulsation of your heart, or the many hearts you don't even know.
So you're
you
like
possess.
A superhero. You're not a mortal.
No, the word hero, I run far away from it, but I know it's a nice word in America. You have gurus, you have heroes, you have gods, but...
Superman.
Superman, yes. I do not have heroes in my life. I have great artists who have inspired me, and I certainly would never label myself as a hero. I am too busy building the next
but
project.
That ability to, on this molecular level, the level of your blood, to not allow for this idea of failure and falling, makes you not only like most people, not like anyone I can imagine.
Well, you can pronounce toward me the word alien, and
okay.
I will be honored. But the word hero, no.
Okay. There's a particularly gasp-inspiring still of you on the wire between the buildings, where there's this big jetliner over your shoulder, essentially. And one, as one sees that, can't help but think of 9/11. Do you remember having at this, doing this wondrous, amazing, marvelous thing 20 years 18 years later, hearing about 9/11 and what you thought?
What is beautiful is what James decided to show in his film, is that those towers are still present, and it will be very nice, besides remembering them in their drama and in their horror and death, it will be nice that there is a work of art, a beautiful film, that remembers those towers in their glory. Even people who are completely living into the drama part, let's say people who lost their loved one in a disaster of 9/11, they come to James and I and says, you know, it's amazing, it's a revelation. I realize, actually, when you lose somebody, you should remember that person in tears, but also in laughter, in doom, but also in glory. So I think it's beautiful that James decided to really separate my adventure. Yes, the thing in common with 9/11 is the Twin Towers, but those Twin Towers had a life before they had a death, and that's what this film is about.
And of course, you know, we're all aware of the subtext, and it's there for everyone. Everyone in the whole world is familiar with the imagery and the fact of their demise, and it felt a blasphemy to burden Philippe's story with any discussion or any reference to that horror show. And it's a film and a story about them being built and then being conquered and being celebrated in a certain kind of way. And it would be wrong to put some kind of crass interpretation on that. And I think people should enjoy the film for what it is, as a celebration of this, you know, miracle that was performed down there, this gripping kind of adventure story.
Philippe, did you like the buildings?
I fell in love with them. I am unable to stretch a cable between two structures that I do not fall in love with.
Really?
And repeatedly in my life, in a silly way, I say no to high-wire propositions. I am not interested. And it's usually because artistically it makes no sense for me.
If there were two buildings of the right height suitable to you and you fell in love with them, would you want to repeat this?
Well, yes, and I actually publicly announced that long time ago. I said if the two towers are rebuilt in some kind of twin ways, you know, not exactly the same, but two towers, I will offer to New York to do a walk, you know, a dance against doom in some ways, and have all New York and whole world, you know, celebrating the fact that it's built again, except unfortunately, very unfortunately, there will be one structure, not two, so I obviously need two structures to walk on a high wire.
Maybe from this film, the developers will help get the idea that some of the subsequent buildings, two of the subsequent buildings could be twins.
Well, they certainly had enough time to talk about it.
And they'll have more. Well, thank you both very much.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
And I'll be sure to get my button sewn back on. Man on Wire is out this weekend. We have some video from the movie and photos of our walk around Ground Zero at studio360.org. Coming up, the star of Meatballs and Caddyshack admits to a bad case of writer's block.
There's a whole list. I should probably write a poem about the list of my frustrations. As a matter of fact, if I may borrow your pencil, that's what I'm going to do when I get home.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
PRI's Studio 360 is supported by DK Eyewitness Travel, publisher of guides to hundreds of destinations around the world. Now available wherever books are sold. DK Eyewitness Travel, showing what others only tell. Information at traveldk.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Every year, an organization called Poets House organizes a walk across the Brooklyn Bridge, partly to raise money, partly to raise awareness of poetry. And like any good cause, from climate change to toys for tots, poetry can always use famous faces. Studio 360's Eric Molinsky tagged along a couple of weeks ago to catch up with one of his idols.
Summer is a great time to walk across the Brooklyn Bridge, especially with a bunch of poets.
You can almost read New York City like a poem. Each street is like a line. It's so enjambed. There's kind of a rhythm and a pace to each block. And so the bridge walk is a way to do a close reading.
Lee Brissetti's a board member at Poets House. It's a national center for poetry. They do this fundraiser every year where they walk across the Brooklyn Bridge. There were esteemed poets, wannabe poets, patrons of the arts, and a celebrity. You know Tom's of Maine Toothpaste? Well, Tom Chappelle was there with his wife, Kate.
We use poetry a lot in our company.
Well, I've used your toothpaste.
Well,
my whole family does,
believe
actually.
Believe it or not, it's one of the ingredients in your toothpaste indirectly.
Really?
Because we start every meeting with a poem. So.
Really?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, there was another celebrity that I wanted to meet.
You write poetry, right?
Not for a long time, but.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But it used to get you out of doing homework in grade school if you could write poetry. You know, you could act distracted all the time.
Yeah, that's Bill Murray. He comes to this event almost every summer.
I've got an annoying neighbor named Frank Platt who's on the board, and he's been dragging me around, making me do things all around New York for about 20 years, been making me go and do things that I would never do.
Thank you, Bill. It was a snap.
Frank Platt really is Bill Murray's next-door neighbor. He watched Murray's kids grow up.
See, this guy here crossed the bridge when he was 2 weeks old, maybe less than 2 weeks old.
Oh, really?
Lincoln Murray, yeah. And that's Homer Murray, and Cooper Murray. Yeah, well, oh, and there go the Murrays.
When Frank Platt met Bill Murray in the mid-1980s, Murray was already deep into poetry. He'd show up at Harvard unannounced to read poems to the students. But his own poetry was pretty bad, and he knew it.
Did you ever have ambitions of, you know, maybe even publishing some of your old poems or no?
No. No, I need an injection of ambition,
yeah,
to be honest with you.
So is it just too frustrating to try and write poetry when you would love?
My frustrations start early. They start early and end late, you know what? There's a whole list. I should probably write a poem about the list of my frustrations. As a matter of fact, if I may borrow your pencil, that's what I'm going to do when I get home. I'm going to write a poem about the list of my frustrations.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
I appreciate this a lot. I'm glad I woke up today.
Getting involved with Poets House, Murray was able to meet some of his own personal heroes, like Billy Collins.
I wrote one about divorce recently that's really wicked, that also feels like it echoes in your ribs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Murray's divorce was all over the tabloids that week. I wasn't sure if he'd show up, but he loves this organization. I have to admit, I was just there to meet him. I don't know much about poetry. But throughout the walk and the dinner afterwards, I heard some really great stuff.
Praise the cook with a shaven head and a tattoo on his shoulder that said, Oye. A blue-eyed Puerto Rican with people from Fajardo, the harbor of pirates centuries ago. Praise the lighthouse in Fajardo, candle glimmering white, to worship the dark saint of the sea, Alabanza.
A conversation stops and I look up to see the harmony of the cables and the arch. I have been raised to see the world in terms of work.
We wanted our sufferings to be offered up as tender meat and our triumphs to be belted out as raucous song.
I eat oatmeal for breakfast. I make it on the hot plate and put skimmed milk on it. I eat it alone.
Bill Murray read a poem called Oatmeal by Galway Canal.
But when he got home, he couldn't figure out the order of the stanzas, and he and a friend spread the papers on a table, and they made some sense of them, but he isn't sure to this day if they got it right. He still wonders about the occasional sense of drift between stanzas and the way here and there a line will go into the configuration of a Muslim at prayer, then raise itself up and peer about, and then lay down slightly off the mark, causing the poem to move forward with God's reckless wobble.
Canal's poem is about the frustration of trying to write poetry. I think Bill Murray related to it.
Oh, you're too kind. Well, maybe I will read some of my own stuff.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Malinsky.
And if you'd like to hear Angelina Jolie reading T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, kidding, but you really can hear Bill Murray reading three terrific poems by other people on our website, studio360.org. And while you're there, tell us about a poem that you love. Now, I'll go first. There's only one poem I know by heart, which I was assigned to learn about 35 years ago. It's by John Keats, and it starts like this. Much have I traveled in the realms of gold, and many goodly states and kingdoms seen. Oft of one wide expanse had I been told that bards in fealty to Apollo hold, and so on and so on. Now, tell us your favorite at studio360.org. Whenever there's buzz around some hip young artist these days, it's often somebody who's mixing media and technology in some cool new way. Not Kehinde Wiley. He makes a kind of art that's been around for centuries. Classical portrait paintings. Regal men in heroic poses with swords, on thrones, on horseback. When he started making his portraits, Wiley was an artist in residence at the Studio Museum in Harlem.
I was scouting for models in the streets of Harlem. Young men between the ages of 18 and 35. I was very interested in finding people who had a sense of sort of alpha male presence, a sense of charisma and personal style. And I invited them to the studio to have a very classical sitting.
He paints huge canvases with bright, bold colors, magentas, blues, and yellows. Virile young black men strike poses against these ornately patterned backgrounds. Instead of ruffles and velvet, they wear baggy jeans and sneakers. It's like the 18th century gone day glow. It sounds comical at first, but as you look closely, it really starts making sense.
So much of the history of painting is the propaganda of self-aggrandizement.
And so much of this present moment. So some producers at VH1 picked up on that and asked Wiley to paint the portraits of a kind of contemporary royalty. Hip-hop royalty. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
LL Cool J, Grandmaster Flash, Salt-N-Pepa,
Ice-T.
And so much of what I had been known for in some ways was taking the relatively unknown moment, the guy who was minding his own business, trying to get to the subway one day, and inviting him to be in a 20-foot grandopulent painting, and that moment of chance becomes heroicized. Whereas in these other paintings, we have people who in many ways are heroes to me and to many other people like me, and I was able to be at the leading edge of that heroicizing moment.
No, it was sort of turning you into your 18th century models, right? I mean, if you know, LL Cool J is the equivalent of General So-and-So of 1760.
Sure.
Kehinde Wiley's studio in Brooklyn is your standard successful artist loft. High ceiling, ratty furniture, piles of magazines and takeout wrappers, paint, brushes. Then there his work. These giant canvases leaning against all the walls, some of them 20 or 25 feet long, and scurrying all over the place, two little dogs who never leave Wiley alone.
Now, you have these little greyhounds mm-hmm. in your studio. Do they get in the way of painting?
They get in the way of painting. They urinate on paintings. They're barking at people, as you saw on the way in, but they're my buddies, and we deal with them.
Yeah.
So
should we look around at some of these?
Sure.
This work?
Right now, Kehinde is working on a series called The World Stage, Africa, Lagos, Dakar. He traveled to Africa and found his models for these paintings there. And he based his subjects' poses on particular public sculptures in African cities. Here we are looking at a picture, a larger-than-life-size portrait of two young men in
Senegal. In this particular painting, you're looking at two young men who were back-to-back with their hands clasped together in the front scene. With their other hands, they're both holding onto a piece of cloth, drawing it tautly.
Blazing reflections of activism are coming back.
So there is a specific public sculpture in Senegal on which that pose is based?
Yes, in front of the National Assembly, in fact.
Uh-huh.
In the background, there's the pattern of West African fabric that was sourced from the marketplaces of each of those cities.
They're so beautiful. I mean, all of your work is incredibly beautiful, but the use of these fabrics is really, it's really, really beautifully done. And because it goes, the pattern of the fabric goes in front of them as well as behind them, you're messing with the
foreground
and the...
Yeah, I always had trouble with figure-to-ground relationships in painting. Some of those more romantic portraits that I'd seen as a kid.
Do you remember when you went to museums and first saw Titian or Angler or whomever?
I think my earliest memories were at the Huntington Library.
You grew up in Los Angeles?
Grew up in L.A. And there's a large collection of British portraiture. That was really impactful for me, I think, because of all the pomp and circumstance that was in it. Particularly for me as a sort of young black kid who hadn't really interfaced with something of this type of artifice before. It was just
I don't think many young white kids have either, to be true. But I know what you mean.
I don't think so.
Of the grandeur? Yeah.
No, I think in the sense of museum culture.
Right.
By and large, when I went to the great museums of California, there weren't people who happened to look like me.
Yeah.
By and large, I was
the black kid
there. I say that specifically to point to some of the aspects in which race plays into the work that I do now. And it does have to do with presence and non-presence.
The colors of the clothes of the models in these paintings are so intense.
A lot of that is tweaking it on the computer. All of my work is made from photo.
Uh-huh.
The process is to take the photo first and then to go into Photoshop and begin changing things, taking what would normally have been a red shirt and making it day glow pink, and then going out and trying to source that paint. I love the ability to go through thousands of incarnations at the click of a mouse, and conversely, to be able to take the clothing from one model and simply place them on another and say, well, I like this combo better.
You sort of got the best of both worlds, right? Of this very, very old tradition of painting, and now let me mix it up in this digital way.
Yeah. I think in painting, one thing that we still have is the trace of human presence, hand to paper. And the more you get away from the traditional forms, the more it only heightens that very essential human element.
When President Obama takes office and you're asked to make the presidential portrait, would that be an interesting commission?
I'd do it wholeheartedly. Look forward to that day.
Thanks. Appreciate it. There is an exhibit of Kehinde Wiley's work up through the fall in New York City at the Studio Museum in Harlem. And at studio360.org, we have a slideshow of our visit with him, including some exclusive glimpses of his work in progress. We're listening to a track by DJ Shadow from the record that first got him noticed in the hip-hop world. DJ Shadow's album Introducing, in fact, is in the Guinness Book of World Records as the first album made up entirely of electronic samples of earlier music, a lot of them from LPs he rescued from the 50 Cent bin. His music is almost entirely instrumental, and he developed his fetish for old-fashioned vinyl early, when he was a kid.
I always had a lot of appreciation for how durable records are, because you can really put them through paces and they'll still play. And I remember once, as an experiment, I left it out on our driveway, and I was really disappointed when after a week of 90-degree heat, nothing happened. And it just wouldn't warp, and I remember thinking, like, what a ripoff. That's why I liked records, because you could abuse them, you could love them, you could play with them, and they would still provide the music you were looking for.
Studio 360's Derek John has been a fan of that music since his days as a college radio DJ in Kansas.
KJHK 90.7 FM. We are your sound alternative.
10 years ago, I DJed a morning show called Breakfast for Beat Lovers. And if you think that title is cheesy, well, you should have heard the host.
Call me up 864-4747 with requests, shout-outs. Give props to your homies.
Did I mention it was an all-volunteer radio station? But the best thing about hosting Breakfast for Beat Lovers was that I got to play a ton of DJ Shadow.
I'll start off with this DJ Shadow joint.
And back then, nobody else did beats quite like him. With two turntables and a pair of headphones, Shadow elevated record scratching from parlor trick to high art. But who was the guy? Shadow was as elusive as his name, and it was only later that I discovered the great DJ Shadow was just a white kid from the suburbs, like me.
1, 2, 1, 2, mic check. I was born in San Jose, and we moved to a place called Davis, California when I was 5. We were a semi-struggling middle-class kind of household. Like, I had an AM radio that I would just put a little $10 kind of cassette recorder up against the speaker and record an urban AM station called KFRC. I still want to find the cassette of when I, you know, leaned over as I was about to fall asleep and put the cassette recorder to the speaker. I think my mom and my stepdad come in and go like, "What are you listening? What is this?" But to their credit, you know, they just kind of shook their head and closed the door.
Behind that closed door, an aspiring young DJ was doing his homework, studying guys like Jam Master Jay of Run DMC.
When I finally got a turntable in 84, I was able to imitate the patterns, but I didn't know the records. I didn't know what that was. Or the, like, Rocket in the Pocket, which took me years to figure out. I remember just being, like, incredibly excited to hear the original source.
I know exactly how Shadow feels. There's a strange thrill in discovering an original sample after first hearing it used in a hip-hop beat. And by the time I heard DJ Shadow's own work in the late 90s, it was a revelation. Nothing but samples.
Ooh, hold up, before we get started.
Guess who's coming?
It's
guess who's coming?
It's
guess who's coming?
DJ Shadow.
Back again.
Who is he?
Just your favorite DJ savior.
In the process of working on Introducing, there'd be times where, you know, you just get stuck. You write yourself into a corner, whatever the analogy would be, where you kind of go, you know what, I'm confused, I'm stuck.
You're just fessing, man. I don't even want to hear about it. You're just fessing.
And so what I would do is get in my car, drive half an hour to Sacramento, and go to a store there that I had recently acquired access to the basement.
Now, any vinyl junkie knows that a record store basement is hallowed ground, accessible only to a chosen few.
After being turned down several times, eventually, I got the deep breath and the, okay, but just don't, you know, be careful down there. Don't move stuff around.
Shadow was in, but did he know what he was in for?
There'd be lots of times where part of the roof would fall on a stack of records. So as I'm flipping through them, you'd basically blow a big cloud of the stuff into your face and just sit there and cough for a while.
And then there was the mummified bat.
Yeah, mummified bat. At a certain point, I thought maybe I should start wearing a mask, but it just didn't feel right.
Today's DJs have it easy. They can just grab anything they need from their computer hard drive, whereas Shadow spent months rummaging around for his beats.
You could go to a different part of the basement on any given day, and it occurred to me that karmically, you know, depending on what I found that day, it would decide the course of the work that I did. Any pivotal sample that you care to think of, chances are I found it down there.
At least eight of those samples were used in one track called Changeling. The opening keys are from the Chaffee College Jazz Ensemble, whoever that is. There's a bass line from some obscure German krautrock band. Two different drum samples, one from New Orleans Funky Meters, and another from a 60s Canadian band called Motherload.
Yep. Motherload.
By the end of the track, we've heard vocals from Loudon Wainwright III, a clip from a John Carpenter movie, and guitar licks from a New Age healer named Kay Gardner. Kay who? In the end, it doesn't really matter.
I was kind of interested at the time in taking a 4/4 beat or taking a straight-ahead break and kind of getting into other time signatures, taking them completely out of their element, really just kind of freaking it. I wanted to make people go, wait a minute, how did he do that? Rap was about taking what was around you when you had nothing and making something original out of it. And that was the same with sampling. I mean, I liked the whole renegade kind of robbery aesthetic of it. A lot of it was kind of a middle finger, like, I'm going to take your, you know, famous song that you all love, and I'm going to just sort of pee on it. Because that's hip-hop. That's it's confrontational.
Wait a minute. Confrontational? That's not how DJ Shadow comes across. More like a quiet professor of vinyl studies, each sample a footnote in his dissertation.
Now, let me give you the picture of what's going on.
But as much as Shadow reveres the past, he doesn't want to be stuck there himself.
It is supposed to still be about looking forward, and that's why I think I tend to support aspects of hip-hop and rap music that do look forward.
On his last album, Shadow tried something different, producing a more hardcore, aggressive rap from the Bay Area. If you look at online fan sites, people hated it. So, Shadow's got a little problem on his hands. 12 years ago, he made Introducing, a record that was so good, fans like me still haven't gotten over it. But we gotta give the guy a break.
As an artist, you hope that eventually you make something that people connect to so emotionally that they feel like they own part of it. But it was called Introducing with an E&D for a reason. That's why I've never really felt that I need to kind of repeat it or expand on it or explore it further.
For Studio 360, I'm Derek John.
DJ Shadow is on tour this summer, playing nothing but 45 RPM records. In a moment, a simple medical procedure has some surprising consequences.
Your little accent is gone.
What accent?
You know, the little Norwegian thing.
Norwegian?
Isn't your mom Norwegian?
She's from Denver.
A short story by Miranda July. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
PRI Studio 360 is supported by DK Eyewitness Travel, publisher of guides to hundreds of destinations around the world. Now available wherever books are sold. DK Eyewitness Travel. Showing what others only tell. Information at traveldk.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Pick your medium. Miranda July has probably tried it and mastered it. She was a performance artist, a writer, and the director and star of the fine indie film You and Me and Everyone We Know. Last year, she published a collection of short fiction called No One Belongs Here More Than You. It's out now in paperback, and she came into Studio 360 to read her story, Birthmark.
On a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being childbirth, this will be a 3.
A 3? Really?
Yes, that's what they say.
What other things are a 3?
Well, 5 is supposed to be having your jaw reset.
So it's not as bad as that.
No.
What's 2?
Having your foot run over by a car.
Wow, so it's worse than that.
But it's over quickly.
Okay, well, I'm ready. No, wait, let me adjust my sweater. Okay, I'm ready.
All right, then.
Here goes a 3.
The laser, which had been described as pure white light, was more like a fist slammed down on a countertop, and her body was a cup on the counter, jumping with each slam. It turned out 3 was just a number. It didn't describe the pain any more than money describes the thing it buys. $2,000 for a port wine stain removed. A kind of birthmark that seems messy and accidental, as if this red area covering one whole cheek were the careless result of too much fun. She spoke to her body like an animal at the vet.
Shh, it's okay. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry we have to do this to you.
This is not unusual. Most people feel that their bodies are innocent of their crimes, like animals or plants. Not that this was a crime. She had waited patiently from the time she was 14 for aesthetic surgery to get cheap, like computers. 1998 was the year lasers came to the people as good bread. Eat and be full. Be finally perfect. Oh, yes, perfect. She didn't think she would have bothered if she hadn't been what people call very beautiful except for. This is a special group of citizens living under special laws. No one knows what to do with them. We mostly want to stare at them like the optical illusion of a vase made out of the silhouette of two people kissing. Now it's a vase. Now it could only be two people kissing. Oh, but it is so completely a vase. It is both. Can the world sustain such a contradiction? And this was even better, because as the illusion of prettiness and horribleness flipped back and forth, we flipped with it. We were uglier than her. Then suddenly we were lucky not to be her, but then again, at this angle, she was too lovely to bear. She was both. We were both. And the world continued to spin. Now began the part of her life where she was just very beautiful, except for nothing. Only winners will know what this feels like. Have you ever wanted something very badly and then gotten it? Then you know that winning is many things, but it is never the thing you thought it would be. Poor people who win the lottery do not become rich people. They become poor people who won the lottery. She was a very beautiful person who was missing something very ugly. Her winnings were the absence of something, and this quality hung around her. There was so much potential in the imagined removal of the birthmark. Any fool on the bus could play the game of guessing how perfect she would look without it. Now there was not this game to play. There was just a spent feeling. And she was no idiot. She could sense it. In the first few months after the surgery, she received many compliments, but they were always coupled with a kind of disorientation.
Now you can wear your hair up and show your face off more.
Yeah, I'm going to try it that way.
Wait, say that again?
I'm going to try it that way. What?
Your little accent is gone.
What accent?
You know, the little Norwegian thing.
Norwegian?
Isn't your mom Norwegian?
She's from Denver.
But you have that little bit of an accent, that little way of saying things.
I do?
Well, not anymore. It's gone now.
And she felt a real sense of loss, even though she knew she'd never had an accent. It was the birthmark, which in its density had lent color even to her voice. She didn't miss the birthmark, but she missed her Norwegian heritage, like learning of new relatives, only to discover they have just died. All in all, though, this was minor, less disruptive than insomnia, but more severe than déjà vu. Over time, she knew more and more people who had never seen her with the birthmark. And these people didn't feel any haunting absence. Why should they? Her husband was one of these people. You could tell by looking at him. Not that he wouldn't have married a woman with a port wine stain, but he probably wouldn't have. Most people don't and are none the worse for it. Of course, sometimes it would happen that she would see a couple and one of them would have a port wine stain and the other would clearly be in love with this stained person and she would hate her husband a little. And he could feel it.
Are you being weird?
No,
you are.
Actually, I'm not. I'm just eating my salad.
I can see them too, you know. I saw them come in.
Hers is worse than mine. Mine didn't go down on my neck like that.
Do you want to try this soup?
I bet he's an environmentalist. Doesn't he look like one?
Well, maybe you should go sit with them.
Maybe I will.
I don't see you moving.
Did you just finish the soup? I thought we were splitting.
Well, I offered it to you.
Well, you can't have any of this salad then. It was a small thing, but it was a thing, and things have a way of either dying or growing, and it wasn't dying. Years went by. This thing grew, like a child, microscopically every day. And since they were a team, and all teams want to win, they continuously adjusted their vision to keep its growth invisible. They wordlessly excused each other for not loving each other as much as they had planned to. There were empty rooms in the house where they had meant to put their love, and they worked together to fill these rooms with mid-century modern furniture. Herman Miller, George Nelson, Charles and Ray Eames. They were never alone. It became crowded. The next sudden move would have to be through the wall. What happened was this. She was trying to get the lid off a new jar of jam, and she was banging it on the counter. She banged it too hard, and the jar broke. She screamed. Her husband came running when he heard the sound. There was red everywhere, and in that instant he saw blood. Hallucinatory clarity, you are certain of what you see. But then in the next moment, your fear relinquishes control. It was just jam. It was jam. Everywhere. She was laughing, picking shards of glass out of the strawberry mash. She was laughing at the mess, and her face was down, looking at the floor, and her hair was around her face like a curtain, and then she looked up at him and said, "Can you bring the trash over here?" And it happened again. For a moment, he thought he saw a port wine stain on her cheek. It was fiercely red and bigger than he had ever imagined. It was bloodier than even blood, like sick blood, animal blood. The blood racist people think beats inside people of other races, blood that shouldn't touch my own. But the next moment, it was just jam, and he laughed and rubbed the kitchen towel on her cheek, her clean cheek, her port wine stain.
Honey.
Can you get the trash can?
Honey.
What?
Go look in the mirror.
What?
Go look in the mirror.
Stop talking like that. Why are you talking like that? What?
He was looking at her cheek. She instinctively put her hand on the mark and ran to the bathroom. She was in there for a long time, maybe 30 minutes. You've never had 30 minutes like these.
She stared at the port wine stain, and she breathed in, and she breathed out. It was like being 23 again, but she was 38 now. 15 years without it, and now here it was, in the same exact place. She rubbed her finger around its edges. It came as high as her right eye, over to the edge of her right nostril, across her whole cheek to the ear, ending at her jawbone, in purplish red. She wasn't thinking anything. She wasn't afraid or disappointed or worried. She was looking at the stain the way one would look at oneself 15 years after one's own death. Oh, you again. Now it was obvious that it had always been there. She had startled it back into sight. She looked into the redness and breathed in and breathed out. And found herself in a kind of trance. She thought, I am in a kind of trance. She was just blowing around. It lasted about 25 minutes, a very, very long time to be just blowing around. Mostly you waft for a second or two, a half second maybe, and then you spend the rest of your life trying to describe it, to regain the perspective. You say, it was like I was just blowing around, and you wave your arms in the air. But there were no arms like that, and you know it. She came out of the trance like a plane taking off. Instead of being inside the stain, she was now looking down on it from above. Like a lake, it grew smaller and smaller until it was only a tiny region in a larger mass, one that this pilot favored. Hovered over, but would not touch down on again. He found himself kneeling. He was waiting for her on his knees. He was worried that she would not let him love her with the stain. He had already decided long ago, 20 or 30 minutes ago, that the stain was fine. He'd only seen it for a moment, but he was already used to it. It was good. It somehow allowed them to have more. They could have a child now, he thought. There was a loose feeling in the air. The jam was still on the floor, and that was okay. He would just kneel here and wait for her to come out and hope that he would be able to tell her about the looseness in a loose way. He wanted to keep the feeling.
He hoped she wasn't removing it somehow, the stain. She should keep it, and they should have a kid. He could hear her blowing her nose. Now she was opening the door. He would stay on his knees, just like this. She would see him this way and understand.
That's Miranda July reading her story Birthmark, with production by Studio 360's Pike Malinowski. Let us know what you thought of that story or anything else you heard today at studio360.org. I've just returned from a trip to Washington State, so it's with special pleasure that I welcome our new listeners in Spokane, Washington, who hear us on KPBX. That is the show for this week. Thanks very much for listening. I hope you'll listen again next week. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Malinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Catherine Epstein,
Jill Duboff,
Aaron Davis,
Catherine Iden.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegel. We'd especially like to thank some of our WNYC colleagues who worked so hard with us on last week's live show from the Aspen Ideas Festival. They were Ed Haber, Rob Christensen, Nuala McGovern, Chris Bannon, and Lisa Allison.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, musician Ry Cooder pays tribute to Johnny Cash on his new CD.
The first time I ever heard Hey Porter, when I was 8, I remembered every word. And so I spent a lot of years, boom, chick, boom, chick, boom, chick, boom, chick, playing that stuff.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Hey, Porter, hey, Porter, would you tell me the time?
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.